The Democratic Party platform is nothing more than a new form of climate denial. One that admits that climate change is real, but refuses to take the actions necessary to stop it. These conciliatory nods and appeals for incrementalism only perpetuate environmental racism and sacrifice lives and livelihoods for private gain.
We are here to remind them that they are not doing their jobs, they are not representing the people, their party platform is not progressive, and we're trying to ask them why this party keeps shifting to the center, if not to the right, and have the nerve to call themselves progressive, because they're just not.
It's not just about individual police, it's about policing, it's about how we extend rights to police officers that aren't afforded to citizens every day.
And welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in the nation's capital. I'm Esther Averam. Well, today, on the road to Philadelphia, occupying, resisting, and creating a counter-narrative to the Democratic National Convention, and definitely to the Republican National Convention. Starting next Monday is the DNC in Philadelphia, and thousands of activists are gathering in the city of brotherly love to push the party to again be the party of working people, to be the party of racial justice and environmental justice. And some are building independent movements. There are actions on climate, on Black Lives Matter, on a host of issues, including income inequality. Today we'll feature an interview with the organizer of the People's Convention, which kicks off tomorrow, Saturday, in Philadelphia. And later in the show, speak to our geopolitical analyst, Gerald Horn, about Donald Trump, the Republicans, and so much that has happened during the past week. But first, our headlines. As a sort of mini prelude to what will be a jam-packed week of activism in Philadelphia next week, inside and outside the DNC, demonstrators gathered Thursday at the congressional offices of DNC Chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz to protest what they called the DNC's new form of climate denial. The protesters then marched to the DNC headquarters, where several people locked themselves together with PVC pipe and blocked the entrance.
I'm Melinda Tuhus. I'm with Beyond Extreme Energy, also known as BXE. And we're out here today because we believe that the platform that the Democratic National Committee ended up with is not powerful enough to deal with the climate crisis that we're in.
Okay, and I see there are four particular issues that you're highlighting. What are they?
One is to ban fracking, which was, you know, Bernie Sanders talked about throughout his whole campaign. One is to stop the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because we believe it's not just a trade deal. It's a deal to export natural gas, fracked gas, which will just make the create more fracking in this country for export. And that, you know, whatever goes in the atmosphere affects everybody all around the world. Another one is no drilling in the Gulf. We don't want any new drilling. People in the Gulf are demanding no more drilling. It's a sacrifice zone, and what they want are jobs to clean up the existing mess that's there and to transition to clean energy jobs, and we support that. And the last one is no eminent domain for private gain, because FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, gives permission to companies when they approve their pipeline proposals to take property by eminent domain if homeowners aren't willing to let them come on their property. And it destroys the property value, and it often harms people's health and their whole quality of life, and we think that that's not fair.
Okay. So I know that there's a big climate march in Philadelphia coming up, I think, just before their convention starts. Is this action leading into Philadelphia?
Well, many of us are certainly going to Philadelphia. By the way, it's going to be 100 degrees on Sunday in Philadelphia for the march. So if anybody needed a reminder about, you know, climate change and increasing temperatures, I think that's going to be it, which is really kind of scary.
Anthony Rogers Wright, and I'm the Policy Director for Environmental Action. We're out here today because we are quite frankly shocked and very disappointed in the Democratic Party for not taking a stand on climate change, a real stand on climate change. This is a party that in their party platform refused to flat out reject the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which we know will wreak environmental catastrophe all around the world. We also know that the TPP is all about the trading of natural gas. Two-thirds of the countries that are involved in TPP are the top 50 importers of natural gas in the world. The United States is one of the biggest producers of natural gas, and that's what it's about, in addition to massive job losses, a race to the bottom, and it's all about corporate profits. So we're disappointed about that. We're disappointed that a party that claims to be for the people, the party of the people, the party where people of color are supposed to turn to, called for the end of offshore drilling in the Arctic with their polar bears and the Atlantic with their New England clam chowder, but not in the Gulf of Mexico, which has one of the highest concentrations of people of color who are also very, very poor. We don't understand why the Gulf of Mexico continues to be one of America's favorite sacrifice zones, and why the party of the people won't stand up for those very vulnerable people. And we're here to basically call them out and say that climate denial is not just monopolized by the Republicans and boogeymen like Senator James Inhofe and Senator Ted Cruz. It's also the Democrats who are acting like climate deniers right now, because they are denying the science of climate change, which because they were also, by the way, disappointed that they would not call for a party platform that calls for a national ban on fracking. As Ted Glick just said, formerly of CCAN, we know that methane, which is what natural gas is 80 times more potent than carbon dioxide. And so, and we also reject the idea that it is a bridge from coal. Okay, it is a gangplank, and it is a bridge to climate catastrophe. So we are here to remind them that they are not doing their jobs. They are not representing the people. Their party platform is not progressive. And we're trying to ask them why this party keeps shifting to the center, if not to the right, and have the nerve to call themselves progressive, because they're just not.
The protesters blocking the entrance to the Democratic National Committee were threatened with arrest, but declared victory after 3 hours and left after several DNC staffers came out to speak with them, including Ian Russell, deputy director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Thousands of activists in the Movement for Black Lives rallied at actions across the country yesterday for the Freedom Now, July 21st Collective Action for Justice. Here in D.C., there was an 8 a.m. rally and a day-long calling of action at the D.C. Office of Police Complaints in Northwest D.C. to call on the office to investigate the death of Sherman Evans, who was shot to death by Metropolitan Police officers. Sean Blackman of the Stop Police Terror Project spoke to reporters.
I'm out here supporting Surge, Stand Up for Racial Justice, D.C. I'm at the Office of Police Complaints, particularly around the killing of a 63-year-old black man in Washington, D.C. named Sherman Evans,
yes,
who was killed by police here recently. And we know that this is actually just one of quite a few police killings that have happened in Washington, D.C. recently. I mean, Mr. Evans was one, I believe, of two black people that were killed just on July 4th. You see what I mean? And we know that recently Alonzo Smith was killed in Southeast D.C. by so-called private security. Rafael Briscoe, 18 years old, was killed by Metropolitan Police. You see what I mean? And so it's really just an example of Washington, D.C. Recognizing how racist police terror manifests itself locally.
Thursday's National Day of Action occurred as new video of a senseless shooting of a black man by police in North Miami went viral. The video shows behavioral therapist Charles Kinsey laying on his back with his hands up when the police shot him. Also on Monday, Baltimore police officer Brian Rice was acquitted of all charges in the death of Freddie Gray, an African-American man who died with his spine nearly severed in police custody last year. Now, actions in Philadelphia are actually getting underway tomorrow, but there are also things happening here in D.C. Justice First is organizing a march against slumlords and their enablers, supporting tenants of Congress Heights against displacement and gentrification in Ward 8. The owners of their building, Sanford Capital, want to demolish them to create a market-rate housing And Justice First says that the tenants recently won a victory, allowing them to begin a complex process that could lead to them buying the building from Sanford Capital. The march will begin 11 a.m. at the Cleveland Park Metro Station in Northwest D.C. And also the Leonard Peltier Freedom Ride 2016 of motorcyclists is scheduled to end up here in D.C. tomorrow and Sunday, Saturday and Sunday, after traveling 3,000 miles from Oregon. The riders are gathering outside the U.S. Capitol both days. Visit PeltierJustice.com for more information. And culture and media, Roger Ailes is out at Fox News. There are actually some new laws that make it illegal for you to share your Netflix or HBO account sign-in info and password. We're going to try to bring more information about that because there are a lot of people sharing and cutting down costs out there. The sister who stars in the new Ghostbusters movie revealed a barrage of racist tweets from people calling out of her name and just all manner of things that actually made her quit Twitter for a while, and then she rejoined the service on yesterday in honor of the 67 years that Nelson Mandela devoted to social justice. Artists and the South African embassy joined forces to donate 67 blankets to area charities on Monday. And the winning team of the Brave New Voices International Youth Poetry Slam at the Kennedy Center that we highlighted was Baltimore. So congratulations to Baltimore. Movies this weekend, Star Trek Beyond hits the theaters, and the March on Washington Film Festival continues through tomorrow. That's Saturday, July 23rd. The festival focuses on the events and heroes of the civil rights era and uses the power of film, music, and the arts to share important stories and lessons about activism. The website is marchonwashingtonfilmfestival.org. And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, my conversation with the organizer of another political convention, the People's Convention, which starts tomorrow, Saturday, in Philadelphia. Stay with us. Welcome back to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org. I'm Esther Averam. Well, with the Republican National Convention over, up next on deck starting Monday is the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. And before the DNC gets started, thousands of activists are gathering in the city of brotherly love to push the party to be progressive, to be the party of working people. Well, my next guest won't be pushing the Democrats at all. Jack Rabbit Pollock is an organizer of another convention, the People's Convention, which is being held tomorrow in downtown Philadelphia and which is expected to draw hundreds, and it will feature speakers including Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein and former Ohio State Senator Nina Turner. I spoke to Jack Rabbit last night and began by asking him to react to the Republican convention, which just wound up.
I think that the Republican convention has really shown just how badly American politics has degraded over the past few decades. I think and not only that, but also the complicity that the media, the corporate media, shares in that degradation. You know, I think what we're seeing kind of unfold before our eyes is what happens when democracy is removed from the people. And I think that the two major political parties have really gotten so far away from the needs of the people and just regular everyday people. I think it's gotten so out of hand that we're seeing it definitely not just the Republicans, I think the Democrats as well, but I mean definitely with the Republicans you're seeing a whole class of people that you know, are just completely off the rails and have no accountability to any kind of principles or values that most, I think most Americans would recognize.
So what will the People's Convention be? What do you hope to accomplish in the shadow of this massive major party gathering?
Well, we're doing what we're doing because we want to practice democracy. We want to see if we can really experiment with democracy as I think most Americans imagine that it should be, where it is inclusive and representing, you know, real people, regular people. So our process from the very beginning has been one in which, you know, we have attempted to include as many voices as possible, recognize, you know, the interests of as many people as possible, and allow regular individuals to be involved in the process. And the process that we're putting together is to create a what we're calling a people's platform, which is a list, a crowdsourced list of you know, the issues that are most important to the American public. So our currently we have five platform planks. They are racial justice, climate justice, economic justice, which deals with wealth and income inequality, healthcare for all, and our real democracy plank, which is a combination of getting money out of politics and electoral reform. You know, these are the issues that are most pressing, most important to the American people. And what we've done is we have crowdsourced these platform planks. So what we've done is we've gone to a range, a wide variety of different grassroots organizations that are working on these issues, and we've asked them to provide their, you know, their solutions to these really, really pressing problems.
So, how would you describe the folks coming to the People's Convention? Are these disaffected Bernie Sanders supporters, Green Party folks, folks who have always considered themselves as outside of the Democratic Party, or are some still aligned with the Democratic Party in some way?
Well, what I hope to see is people who are ready to engage in democracy, people who are ready to build a movement and to, you know, build something that can be maintained and is sustainable, want to build alternative institutions to support the kind of really, I think, radical change that needs to happen in American politics. And so, you know, the reason that I say it like that is that, you know, we, while it is true that a lot of the people who are involved were inspired by the Bernie Sanders campaign, you know, this is not about Bernie. You know, what we're proposing is that American democracy should be about a platform and not about parties or personalities. And so, you know, we're really hoping that people who resonate with the ideas in our People's Platform will be interested in participating and being a part of what we're trying to build, which is essentially to try and really gather the energy of that's been generated over this campaign season and really see something that is real and powerful and practical that can have real practical results.
So I noticed you mentioned the platform, and I did look at those different planks that you mentioned on your website. But the fact that so many of the planks that you care about were excluded from the Democratic platform, did that further inspire your convention?
That's a great question. Thank you for that. You know, I think that what we have seen with the Democratic Party's platform process is a real evidence that the People's Platform is really a necessary and important thing. I mean, you know, what we saw was backroom deals. We saw, you know, political power players, you know, moving the decision making back and forth. And the process as a whole really is completely out of touch with the American people. Now, mind you, I mean, you know, Bernie Sanders has, you know, been very public in saying that it's the most progressive platform that the Democratic Party has ever had, and that may very well be true. But doesn't necessarily mean it is the platform that the American public really needs. And as I said, I think that you see that, you know, fracking, a ban on fracking was not a part of the Democratic National Committee's platform. You see that TPP, like an anti-TPP amendment, was not allowed into it, and other things as well. And so I think that what it really illustrates, the process that occurred really illustrates that, you know, what it does is it reminds us that the Democratic Party is a private club. It's a private institution. It's not public. And the fact that it is taxpayer funded, the fact that, you know, the two political parties are really the only game in town, I think is really, it's simply anti-democratic. And I think that ultimately, the people ourselves, we need to take back our power, and we need to build power from the grassroots up, and really demand that we be listened to. And, that has to happen, or else our democracy is pretty much doomed.
So how will the People's Convention make that happen? I mean, you know, many political observers see this election as a game changer, and with more people willing to step outside of those parties. So, I mean, what do you think about that idea, and how does the People's Convention fit into that? Will it tend to support an existing independent party like the Greens? Will it support the formation of something new? And if it does, how will it be effective in time for November?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, I think, again, another really great question. I think that, you know, what we're trying to do with the People's Convention is, I mean, we're not trying to pretend that we have all the answers. What we're trying to do is to experiment with democracy, is to really just kind of propose the idea that we can work together cooperatively to be able to build a real set of demands and solutions to our problems. And then the idea is to be able to have something that we can then hold our elected officials accountable to. The only way that we can make it work is if we work together on it, right? I mean, it's like the really important part of what we're trying to do is the part where we're engaging regular people, where we're saying that this is a way, we're saying that this is a way for regular people to be able to engage in the political process. And we want to be able to take this people's platform and hold our elected officials accountable to it, saying, we will vote for you only if you support this. And, you know, eventually we're hoping to, you know, what we'd like to see happen is people actually, like, using the platform to hold elected officials accountable to it.
So how do you envision that happening? How do you actually make people accountable with these planks that you'll adopt on Saturday?
Well, an example that I have, one of the plans that I have to be able to propose, is to be able to have something as simple as an app that would be able to identify your location and then associate your location with elected officials in your, you know, congressional district, for example, who your senators are, and then associate their votes in relation to the planks of the People's Platform. So finding out, so basically taking the planks from people's platforms, for example, the climate justice plank, right? So, you know, there is a vote, let's say, on a carbon tax, right? And so you have this, you know, you have an elected official that can go on record as supporting a carbon tax or a ban, let's say a ban on fracking, and, you know, will they vote for that? And if they don't vote for it, then you'll know. And then when the next election comes up, right, you can actually have the, you know, the plank, you can use the plank, hold it up against that elected official. Now the thing is that, you know, I think that what we really need to do is we need to take a page out of Bernie's book. What we're going to have to do is we need to have a combination strategy of approaching building power through elections as well as direct action, because the truth of the matter is that right now the people do not have power. But the only power that the people have is the power that they take. And we see that with, like, organizations like Black Lives Matter, but we also see it with the climate justice movement, where people actually stay, you know, they will put their bodies in front of bomb trains, they will blockade oil tankers with kayaks. you know, in the same way that, you know, in cities around the country, Black Lives Matter are occupying, or, you know, a couple days ago, Black Lives Matter occupied the offices of the Police Benevolent Association because they recognize that these people are supporting the kind of system that, you know, that they reject. And, you know, it's these kind of, you know, grassroots actions that bring attention to the issues that politicians need to be addressing. So the thing is, so that's the direct action part, but then there also needs to be politicians, people who are elected to office, who are sympathetic and who will support these policies. You know, and so I think that that is the approach that we need to be taking, where we are willing to actually put our bodies on the line, but then also that we recognize the power of elections, and we engage with those and with the power of elections, and we run candidates who will agree to support the policies that we put in place with the people's platform. So I think it's entirely doable. I don't think it's that complicated. I think it's just a matter of people having the will to engage and feeling like they actually can make a difference. And, you know, because when it comes down to it, I think people in our country are really alienated from the political process because they don't feel like their voice matters. And the reality is that, you know, what we've seen is that it doesn't. It's the corporations that are deciding what gets done. And so, you know, so what we're saying with the People's Convention and beyond the People's Convention is that if people work together and we can agree to cooperate and strategize around a whole range of issues that are really important, that are part of the world that we want to see, you know, then we can really have the future that we believe in.
As you were talking, I was thinking about two of those actions because, right, two of those actions happened right here in D.C. on Wednesday and Thursday here in D.C. Black Lives Matter activists who we're covering actually staged some of those actions in terms of holding the police accountable, targeting particularly the Fraternal Order of Police, and really being very specific about, you know, who they wanted to address in terms of these particular actions. And then also on Thursday, two of the speakers who I think are going to be at the People's Convention, Margaret Flowers and Kevin Spieth, were part of the climate action here in D.C. at Debbie Wasserman Schultz's office, and then out in front of the building of the DNC right here on Capitol Hill. And they chained themselves using the PVC pipe to block the door, and that was one of the things that I covered. And just covering activists, you know, regularly for the last 2 years for this show, I know that one of the issues is the fact that activism is almost a full-time job.
Right.
And the average working person may be working one, maybe two, maybe even more than two jobs. The society is almost set up so that people don't even have time to be engaged. It's almost set up so that, you know, you go to work, you try to take care of your children, you try to help them with their school, you hope that they can do better than maybe you did, and you know, you fall in the bed, you know, exhausted. And for a lot of people, that's their life. And the idea of, I guess I'm wondering, how can activists lure people out of their homes, off their porches, you know, out of their cars, to be more active and find time within this rat race that everyone's, you know, caught up in to be active?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that, you know, you bring up a what I think is really one of the most crucial concerns that I have had over the past few years since I really started getting very active since Occupy Wall Street. And the idea of being able to support revolutionary action over the long term is absolutely one of the most crucial issues that we need to address, and we need to address sooner than later. Because, you know, one of the things that makes the bad guys so strong is that, you know, they have institutions to support them. Right, they have, you know, people get fired up, they get angry, they get upset, they go into the street, they shout, they, you know, they raise their fist, and that's awesome. But then that goes away. It can't last, right? But the problem is that the bad institutions persist. They stick around, right?
And that's a problem. And they're paid to stick around.
Exactly. So my question is, what can we do to build alternative infrastructure, right? What I call a revolutionary infrastructure that supports that kind of action. What you said is, I'm so glad to hear you say that, because I think it's something that I don't hear a lot of. I don't hear almost any of it from progressive or radical or left people. You know, it's really just like, you know, we're pursuing whatever the next, you know, exciting or interesting thing is for us to get fired up about. We burn out, and then we get depressed because nothing changes, and then it's a cycle. And I think the only way for us to break out of that cycle is to be able to figure out what can we do to build that revolutionary infrastructure.
You know, you mentioned taking a page from Bernie. I mean, the fact that he was able to raise so much money really was encouraging to me, because it showed me that people will give for a cause they believe in. And you know, a lot of people probably gave who never gave before. But the thing is, you need resources, you need money, you need to be able to sustain people and sustain organizations. So, you know, I don't know if maybe that is another thing that was instructive or encouraging to you.
Absolutely. No, I mean, like 100%. I think that was the thing that I think that most people were really surprised about when it came to Bernie's campaign was, how did he do that, right? I mean, where did that come from? Nobody expected that somebody who was called a democratic socialist, oh, my God, you know, and had such a progressive platform, like, that we all deserve health care, that we all deserve education, like, oh, my God, it's so radical, who could believe it? You know, and then, lo and behold, yeah, most of us actually do believe it. You know, like, there's a lot of people who actually do want to see those things, and they were willing to actually, you know, donate to Bernie in small amounts. There was enough people that were doing it that they could amazingly sustain. And not just sustain. I mean, let's not forget that Bernie outraised Hillary Clinton one month after another. I mean, he didn't just do okay. He did amazing. That's really the inspiration for the People's Platform kind of came from, is that, you know, a lot of people have been excited about Bernie as a person, as a personality. And what we saw was that people were really excited about these issues. And that they loved Bernie so much because they believed that he was an honest person who they could trust to actually champion these issues. And so I think what I think is the secret sauce is being able to have the issues and promote the issues and push the issues that are really important outside of the party system and figure out a way to kind of like rally people around those issues that are really so important to the American people.
I've been speaking with Jack Rabbit Pollock, a core organizer of the People's Convention, which is being held Saturday in downtown Philadelphia. And what is the website, or how can folks get more information?
Well, you can go to thepeoplesrevolution.org, and, you know, there's a lot of information there, thepeoplesrevolution.org. You can find out more about the People's Convention, how you can plug in and volunteer and all that good stuff.
Okay, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
Make money, but don't both it now. Want to make money, don't change we. We are money changer, but if you're this, we are danger. We work hard for the paper, so we want big fun, and we want size to get out. Don't, trust in our Father God and walk on your way up. Hey, no sell your soul, we change the deal up. Yes, yeah, man, I roll in a one car, well flashing. Ooh, enough for a long time, people say she and a weird type and such yes, like mama lashing. Love people, things say them rare, them blood lashing. But my dream come true, so I'm rich and we happy. Money don't change, we are money changer. If you're this, we are danger. We work hard for the paper, so we want big fun. And we want skyscraper, no girl can't change me. Me a girl changer. Girls no flag my paper. Ask me baby mother daily. Most girl love me like how them love the savior. The boy make girl take money to him in a clothes. Girl a box in the jazz and him can't make a soul. Stay warm anything when last sick for. Him insecure so him a set up our phone. Nuff man a pick up the average man food out. And a pose all around like I him run the town. We no say nothing no for them as girl clothes. As I just show money girl make no boy go down. Money can't change me. Yeah, money changer.
Welcome back to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org. I'm Esther Averam. Oh, if you're just tuning in before the break, that was Jack Pollock, also known as Jack Rabbit Pollock, organizer for the People's Convention that will be held tomorrow in Philadelphia before the Democratic National Convention kicks off on Monday. And the reaction actually to the ending of the Republican convention is coming in fast and furious. The Twitterverse is ablaze and the Facebookverse is ablaze. But right now we're going to get some reaction on those issues, Trump, the Republicans, and other current issues from prolific author and activist Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, and frequent contributor across the Pacifica Network. Good morning, Gerald.
Good morning to you.
Well, I have to get you to weigh in on this right-wing fest that we all witnessed over the past three nights. I couldn't bring myself to watch that much of it. I would put it on mute and just watch it as, silent theater. But what did you think?
Well, we can now use the term strongman in U.S. politics as usually applied to, say, African politics or Latin American politics. Obviously, Donald J. Trump found his inner Mussolini last night. I alone, he says, am capable of solving this dystopia that he just painted a portrait of. But on a more serious level, I think we need to ask some profound and searching questions about how and why it is that this man is still within hailing distance of his chief competitor. I'm speaking of Hillary Rodham Clinton. Why it is that Michael Moore, the award-winning filmmaker, feels that Donald J. Trump will be sworn in as the next U.S. president in January 2017. What does that say about the electorate? More specifically, what does that say about the white electorate? Because a recent poll showed that 0.0% of black people in Ohio, for example, were supporting Trump. Obviously, that white audience you saw last night was not an error. That is to say, it accurately reflects the Trump base. And I think if we are to be honest, we'd also have to say that the color of that crowd last night also, in many ways, accurately reflects who benefited when this so-called republic was established over 240 years ago. And that's something even our friends on the left do not want to engage.
Well, you talked about the strong man persona. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, Donald J. Trump, he paints himself as this billionaire. He talks about how brilliant he is. He talks about how these problems with regard to ISIS, with regard to so-called terrorism, etc., can only be solved by himself with the adept execution of force. In some ways, he is taking the United States down a very dangerous path. I think many of the opinion writers in the Washington Post this morning reflect that notion. What they don't get into is how we got into this mess.
Right. The overall convention continually reminded me of this conversation I've been having about the normalization of hate and the comment that I remember most was the one by Representative Stephen King, I think of Iowa,
where
he went on television and basically said that, he says, this whole white people business, though, does get a little tired. I'd ask you to go back through history and figure out where are these contributions that have been made by these other categories of people that you are talking about? Where did any other subgroup of people contribute more to civilization? So basically on national television, basically making an argument for white supremacy, and it becomes part of the normal conversation and talk. So what's your reaction to that?
Well, obviously, it reflects not only white supremacy, it reflects a certain kind of confusion. That is to say that he tried to clean it up by saying that he was really referring to the, quote, West, unquote, which is sort of the synonym or the sort of euphemism that's oftentimes deployed when people don't want to use the term white. But even there, it's confusion, because if you look at the way some of these folks who write history reflect Stephen King's point of view, they'll point to what happened in what is now Baghdad hundreds of years ago as being a citadel of so-called Western civilization, but Baghdad today is not considered part of the West. He talks about people not having roots in Europe as being part of a subgroup and asking what have they contributed to civilization at the same time when the United States is deep in hock to the People's Republic of China and the People's Bank of China, as Hillary Rodham Clinton herself has pointed out more than once. Once again, it reflects a certain kind of confusion, but more than that, it reflects a certain kind of white supremacy.
I was also interested in the speech by the presidential candidate Pence when he talked about being a Christian first and maybe then a something else than a conservative. And basically, if you look at a lot of his credentials and perhaps his reason for being chosen, it's to appeal to this evangelical base. So when you really look at his record in terms of legislation targeting the LGBTQ population and women's rights, it reminds me of a lot of the points that Chris Hedges raised in his book about Christian fascism, basically, which is like a different way of looking at this long-running, the way fascism has appeared in the past. What do you think about Pence?
Well, there's a movement towards theocracy, not only in the United States, but globally, although the United States has helped to generate this movement. I mean, for example, we all know the story of Afghanistan and how the United States helped to destabilize left forces there in the 1980s, which has helped to give rise to a flourishing kind of theocratic movement. We just saw what happened in Pakistan, the close U.S. ally, where a young Pakistani woman who was engaging a certain kind of exhibitionism became a victim of honor killing. That is to say that her brother strangled her while she was sleeping. That's not the first time, and I dare say it won't be the last time this has happened. It reflects a certain kind of theocratic tendency, not to mention a male chauvinist tendency, which of course Mr. Pence himself exhibits when he talks about leading a crusade against Planned Parenthood.
Can you talk a bit more about that? People may not know about what he did in relationship to Planned Parenthood.
Well, that's one of the distinctions between Mr. Pence and Mr. Trump. Mr. Trump, as his tendency has been all over the map about Planned Parenthood. That's not the case for Mr. Pence, who's tried more than once, particularly in Congress, to defund Planned Parenthood. Likewise, you mentioned LGBTQ rights. Mr. Trump has been all over the map with regard to that issue. Not so for Mr. Pence. So it's going to be very interesting to see how they work things out, although given Mr. Pence's speech a day or so ago, I think that he will be tailing after his presidential nominee, Mr. Trump.
So there were lots of other happenings this week. I guess it's actually technically the end of last week, or I'm trying to remember what morning I woke up to the news of this attempted coup in Turkey. And since then, thousands of people have been either arrested or fired from their jobs. It seems like, you know, Erdogan is really taking advantage of this attempted coup to really do a purge of his imagined or suspected political opposition.
Well, he's still in trouble. Of course, the problem starts when he first becomes prime minister approximately 15 years ago, there's a strong secular and Republican movement in Turkey, particularly in the armed forces. So what happened is that Mr. Erdogan, who represents Sunni Islamist tendencies, hooked up with Fethullah Gulen, who, as you know, now lives in the Poconos in Pennsylvania, who has a very strong, powerful movement that's more along Sufi lines. They collaborated to squash secularism and republicanism, particularly in the military, but in the bureaucracy generally. But then they had a falling out, leading to Mr. Gulen fleeing into exile in the Poconos in Pennsylvania, assisted by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, it appears, or at least Graham Fuller, a certified CIA agent. What's striking is that the Gulen movement has a strong foothold in the military. In the Wall Street Journal just today, it was suggested that 70% of the officers are Gulenists. You know, of course, that they've been very active in starting charter schools in the United States, particularly in black communities. And in an interview that I had with a reporter from The Final Call, the Nation of Islam newspaper, he was telling me that the Gulenists have also been sponsoring trips of black American Muslims, not necessarily the Nation of Islam, but black American Muslims to Turkey. Mm-hmm. Likewise, when President Erdogan was in Washington a few weeks ago, he met with the black American Muslims, particularly in Maryland, and was thought that certain kinds of assistance would be flowing. So this issue of what's going to happen in Turkey, thousands of miles away, is going to have local manifestations, not least since Mr. Erdogan has also fired many teachers. And if any of those teachers are English-speaking, they'll probably be trying to come to the United States and get involved in these charter schools that Mr. Gulen has helped to establish.
So in terms of Turkey, what are some of the other implications in the region? They are considered this major player in this whole refugee crisis. They're supposed to be providing shelter and a safe space for refugees, but they're repeatedly charged with, violating people's human rights. They've had this touch and go relationship with Russia where they shot down a Russian jet, but recently tried to kind of, make amends for that and apologize. And, apparently there was a tremendous amount of, rebuffing of Erdogan at the NATO summit and with people kind of leaving him in the corner by himself. So I'm trying to figure out what exactly is happening and what kind of impact that's going to have in that region and just globally.
Well, there's a lot of suspicion in Turkey and the leadership that the United States was somehow involved in this coup. They point to the fact that Fethullah Gulen has not been extradited. The Turkish leadership says that they provided papers that should lead to its extradition. We'll see what happens. It's also interesting to note that the Turkish media are now reporting that the pilots who shot down the Russian jet some months ago have just been arrested because they, too, have been implicated in this attempted coup. It's also striking to note that just before the coup, Mr. Erdogan had gone to some lengths to improve relations with both Israel and Russia. We'll see what happens going forward. Those relations with Russia will probably continue on an upward trend because Europe most likely will be turning its back on Turkey, not least with regard to membership in the European Union. Another implication might be complicating the U.S. war on so-called terror, that is to say, using Turkish military bases to attack ISIS formations along the Syria-Iraqi border. That may now be up for grabs.
Well, what do you think about this whole issue of this major nuclear installation, a U.S. base being right there, in the control of Turkey, that we use these bases not only to launch these attacks, but this is one of the few nuclear bases that we have kind of so far away from home?
Well, I think that's a real concern given the instability that you see in Turkey right now. It's obviously a reflection of the fact that the anti-nuclear movement needs to escalate its game because it's no telling what could happen to those weapons given the fact that you now have open factionalism and open warfare. And I really have to underscore the point that I'm not sure if Mr. Erdogan is totally in control. After all, these events only erupted about a week ago. Recall that he claims that his vacation spot along the Black Sea was bombed instead of going back to the capital where his massive palace exists in Ankara, the capital. He came to Istanbul, where he formerly served as mayor, suggesting that he was not sure if he would have sufficient forces to back him up in the capital. That was only a week ago. And so it's too soon to say that the story is over.
Okay. Well, do you have any other thoughts before we wrap up?
Well, once again, back to these U.S. elections, I think that the DNC, the Democratic Convention, is starting in Philadelphia, as we all know. We need to ask ourselves some certain questions as to how we are left with a neo-fascist versus a neoliberal. But, of course, you in the District of Columbia, at least, I would assume, will have the opportunity to vote for a green on the ballot. Keep in mind, the U.S. presidential election is 51 different elections, 50 states in the District of Columbia. You can get the most votes and still lose, as Al Gore could probably tell you. And so given the fact that there's little danger of Donald J. Trump winning the handful or less electoral votes in the district, I think that the district could be in the vanguard of helping to show what a left-wing movement can look like.
Okay. I've been speaking with Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston and a frequent contributor across the Pacifica Network. Thank you, Gerald.
Thank you.
And that will do it for us on the Ground, onthegroundshow.org. Thanks again to our guest, Gerald Horn, to Chantel James, and thanks to our engineer, Mike Nasella. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our shows. Please don't forget to like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. I'm Esther Rivera. Raise your voice out there. Peace. I'm